officer of the Chase Manhattan Corporation and the founder of the Trilateral Commission. Aldrich's chief advisor on the commission was Harry Davison, a senior partner at J.P. Morgan & Company. For 2 years, Aldrich and his entourage visited Europe's central banks, including the Bank of England, at the cost of $300,000 to U.S. taxpayers. It was all a ruse to lead Congress to believe that the commission was engaged in a massive study to prevent a future financial crisis. The Duck Shooting Party. On November 22, 1910, shortly after the return of the commission members to America, Davison, at the behest of Morgan, invited Aldrich and a small group of Wall Street bankers to a duck shooting party on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. The group included Frank A. Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, a Rockefeller firm in which Morgan was a principal shareholder, Abraham Platt Andrew, assistant secretary of the Treasury, Charles D. Norton, president of J.P. Morgan's First National Bank of New York, Benjamin Strong, president of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, and Paul Warburg. Vanderlip described how the participants came together as follows. "Despite my views about the value to society of greater publicity for the affairs of corporations, there was an occasion near the close of 1910 when I was as secretive, indeed, as furtive as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. We were told to leave our last names behind us. We were told further that we should avoid dining together on the night of our departure. We were instructed to come one at a time and as unobtrusively as possible to the railroad terminal on the New Jersey littoral of the Hudson, where Senator Aldrich's private car would be in readiness, attached to the rear end of a train for the South. Once aboard the private car, we began to observe the taboo that had been fixed on last names. We addressed one another as Ben, Paul, Nelson, and Abe. Davison and I adopted even deeper disguises, abandoning our own first names. On the theory that we were always right, he became Wilbur and I became Orville. After those two aviation pioneers, the Wright brothers. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen, or else all our time and effort would be wasted." The gathering was to serve the following purposes. 1. To ensure that the Money Trust would gain complete control over the nation's financial resources. 2. To make the money supply elastic in order to reverse the trend of private capital formation and to recapture the industrial loan market. 3. To pool the resources of the nation's banks into one reserve that would serve to protect a few of them from currency drains and bank runs. And 4. To shift inevitable financial losses from the money trust to the U.S. taxpayers. It had been instigated by the problem of competition. In 1910, the number of banks in America had doubled to over 20,000 within a decade. Most of these banks were in the South and West, causing the New York banks to suffer a steady decline of market share. 40% of the institutions were national banks that had been chartered by the federal government. These banks, which were located in every major American city, were allowed to issue their own currency in the form of banknotes. This ability served as a safeguard to financial independence, since it prevented a single centralized agency from gaining control of the nation's economy. Fashioning the Fed. At the Jekyll Island Hunt Club, a property owned by Morgan, Warburg told the group that the bill that they would compose for Congress must avoid any reference to a central bank, since several American presidents, including Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, had railed against the establishment of such an entity. It was sound advice. In 1910, America was the only major economic power without a central bank. Throughout its history, the country had deep suspicion against the very idea of central banking. East Coast bankers with ties to the House of Rothschild pressed the case for centralizing control over the nation's monetary system in a single overarching bank. Their efforts met with resistance from average citizens who maintained, in the spirit of Jackson, that granting such power to one institution was blatantly un-American. The commoners had prevailed for 77 years. An economic coup d'etat. Warburg further advised the group that legislation for a central bank must create an illusion that control of the system would reside with the government, since the chairman of the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., would be appointed by the president and would remain answerable to Congress. For further camouflage, Warburg insisted that the legislation must be presented as a regional system, with the 15 branches responsible for overseeing the financial conditions within their jurisdiction. Such measures were necessary, since the cabal of millionaires at Jekyll Island were plotting the greatest financial and political coup d'etat in American history, the usurpation of Congress's authority, as provided in the Constitution, to create and control the country's money supply. After spending 10 days on the island, the final draft for the new banking system was written by Vanderlip from Warburg's notes. Aldrich, upon returning to Washington, inserted the draft with the pages of the report, a work of 23 volumes, replete with copious analytical data, which was being prepared for Congress by the National Monetary Commission. In 1911, when asked by his fellow Republicans to prepare a bill for financial and monetary reform, Aldrich merely plucked the draft from the voluminous report and presented it to Congress, as though the legislation sprang from 3 years of travel, study, and work by diligent members of the commission, and not the product of a clandestine meeting of duck hunters. It was a sleight of hand that escaped detection, even of Aldrich's many biographers. But, as Robert Burns realized, the best-laid plan of mice and men gang afterglay. The plot was to experience a surprising setback. 11. Control of the World. Money, being naturally barren, to make it breed money is preposterous, and a perversion for the end of its institution, which was only to serve the purpose of exchange and not of increase. Men called bankers we shall hate, for they enrich themselves while doing nothing. Aristotle, Politics. The so-called Aldrich Plan, which had been devised at Jekyll Island, called for the creation of a massive banking octopus, the National Reserve Association, NRA. The central bank of the association would be capitalized with a minimum of $100 million and 15 branches would be set up throughout the country. The branches were to be controlled by member banks on the basis of their financial holdings, that is, banks that were owned or controlled by the money trust. The NRA would issue currency that would be the property of the bank and would hold the deposits of the federal government. For this reason, the power of the association would increase in proportion to the size of the government. Bankers and businessmen from each of the 15 financial districts would elect 30 out of the 39 members of the NRA board. This process would ensure that the system would be self-perpetuating. Aldrich's name on the plan was problematic, as Liaquat Ahmed explains in Lords of Finance. Nelson Aldrich may have been the most knowledgeable member of the Senate about finance, but the cause of central banking in the United States could not have found a worse champion. In a Senate full of very rich men, it was becoming known as the Millionaires' Club. He was one of the richest, having sold his stake in the United Traction and Electric Company of Rhode Island for $10 million. He boasted a grand estate in Newport, Rhode Island, and his daughter Abby had married John D. Rockefeller, Jr. He was a fervent supporter of big business, a bitter enemy of regulation, an advocate of high tariffs. Rumors abounded, furthermore, that he traded political favors for financial contributions. In short, he was the living embodiment of everything that opponents of a central bank most feared. The surprise came when the plan met with fierce opposition. Charles A. Lindbergh, Republican, Minnesota, father of the famous aviator, decried the proposed legislation as an attempt by a handful of unscrupulous bankers to gain unlimited power. In a speech before Congress on June 13, 1911, he said, "Wall Street, backed by Morgan, Rockefeller, and others, would control the Reserve Association, and those, again, backed by all the deposits and disbursements of the United States, and also backed by the deposits of the national banks holding the private funds of the people, which is provided in the Aldrich Plan, would be the most wonderful financial machinery that finite beings could invent to take control of the world." The curtain lifted. In response to Lindbergh's comments, Congress authorized the formation of a committee under the leadership of Arsène Pujol, Democrat, Louisiana, to determine if a money trust had been created to gain control of the U.S. economy. The committee verified that a financial cartel had been established under J.P. Morgan, which controlled over $22 billion in revenue and 112 corporations. It further maintained that the Morgan cartel manipulated the daily transactions on the New York Stock Exchange. Republican President William Howard Taft also hastened the Congress's instantaneous rejection of the Aldrich Plan by vowing to veto the bill as soon as it arrived at his desk. The plan went down in flames even before it was brought to the floor for a vote, and Taft, by making the vow, had unwittingly secured his own political demise. The rigged election. But the money trust remained undeterred by the setback. To ensure the defeat of Taft in the 1912 election, Morgan provided the funding for former President Theodore Roosevelt to run as a candidate for the newly created progressive Bull Moose Party. Morgan also dispatched two of his most trusted agents, banker George Perkins and publisher Frank Munsey, to accompany Roosevelt throughout the campaign. The two men helped with the speeches, drummed up large crowds, and provided the feisty candidate with a steady supply of cash. For the Democratic candidate, the trust opted for Woodrow Wilson, an austere, scholarly figure who lived his life in the shadow of Wall Street. He was close to Andrew Carnegie, shared Carnegie's ideology, and became a trustee of the Carnegie Foundation. As president of Princeton University, his salary was augmented by a yearly stipend from Cleveland Dodge and Cyrus McCormick, directors of Rockefeller's National City Bank. In the midst of the panic of 1907, Wilson said that the country should be guided by a panel of financial experts, with J.P. Morgan as chairman. The Wall Street cabal could not have found a more submissive candidate. In 1912, Wilson was brought by prominent banker Bernard Baruch, like a poodle on a string, to Democratic headquarters in New York, where Wilson agreed, if elected president, to support a revision of the Aldrich Plan, to advocate a graduated income tax, and to seek the approval of Wall Street for appointees to his cabinet. Following the meeting, Wilson received financial backing for his presidential campaign from Baruch, Cleveland Dodge, and Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb. The selection of the bespectacled academician was a masterful subterfuge. It seemed inconceivable that any Wall Street banker would support a Democrat, especially when the party platform contained this plank: "We oppose the so-called Aldrich Bill, or the establishment of a central bank and what is known as the Money Trust." The election went precisely as planned. Wilson won with only 42% of the popular vote. Had Roosevelt not entered the race, most of his votes undoubtedly would have gone to Taft, and Wilson's place in American history would consist of a footnote. The bell tolls. With Wilson in the White House, the Aldrich Bill was repackaged and reintroduced as the Glass Act, named for Senator Carter Glass, who had been an opponent of the Aldrich Bill. in order to convince the public and Congress that the new legislation was really a people's bill, central bankers, including Frank Vanderlip, denounced it, and Senator Aldrich refused to support it. Years later, Vanderlip wrote in his memoirs, "Now, although the Aldrich Federal Reserve Plan was defeated when it bore the name Aldrich, nevertheless, its essential points were all contained in the plan that was finally adopted." On December 23, 1913, the Federal Reserve Act became law. The House vote was 298-60, the Senate 43-25. Upon its approval, Congressman Lindbergh, one of the few who realized the bell was now tolling for Uncle Sam, said, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this act, the invisible government by the money power, proven to exist by the money trust investigation, will be legalized. The money power overawes the legislative and executive forces of the nation and of the states. I have seen these forces exerted during the different stages of this bill. The new law will create inflation whenever the trusts want inflation. It may not do so immediately, but the trusts want a period of inflation because all the stocks they hold have gone down. Now, if the trusts can get another period of inflation, they figure they can unload the stocks on the people at high prices during the excitement and then bring on a panic and buy them back at low prices. The people may not know it immediately, but the day of reckoning is only a few years removed." The Federal Reserve began operations on November 16, 1914, with a capital base of $143 million. The money came from the sale of shares in the 12 district banks. The payments to the Fed's Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. arrived in the form of gold bullion. Each district bank of the Fed was a separate tax-exempt corporation with 9 directors from its region's banking and business community. The shares, in accordance with Section 7 of the Federal Reserve Act, were all owned by private banks and individuals, who received yearly dividends in the amount of 6% of the net revenue. The remaining revenue was transferred to the Board of Governors as a franchise fee. This money was used by the governors to supplement the gold reserves, since gold remained the sole standard of the nation's currency. The shareholders. A partial listing of the 1914 principal shareholders in the Fed's district banks contains the names of N.M. Rothschild, London, Lord Montague Norman, London, Brown, Shipley & Company, London, Alex Brown & Sons, Baltimore, Brown Brothers Harriman, New York, Morgan et Compagnie, Paris, Morgan Grenfell & Company, London, J.P. Morgan Company, New York, Morgan Guaranty Company, New York, Morgan Stanley Company, New York, Lazard Brothers, London, Lazard Frere, Paris, Lazard Brothers, New York, J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation, New York, Schroeder Bank, Hamburg, New York and Montgomery, Alabama, Lehman Stern, New Orleans, Drexel & Company, Philadelphia, National City Bank, New York, William Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Percy Rockefeller, New York Trust, New York Edison, Sherman & Sterling, National Bank of Commerce, later identified as Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, New York Equitable Life, J.P. Morgan, H.P. Davison, J.P. Morgan, North British Mercantile Insurance, London, Levi P. Morgan, New York, First National Bank of New York, Goldman Sachs Bank of New York, Israel Moses Seif Bank of Italy, Royal Bank of Scotland, Bank of Nova Scotia, First National Bank of Boston, First National Bank of Cincinnati, Philadelphia National Bank, First National Bank of Minneapolis, First National Bank of Kansas City, and the American Foreign Banking Corporation, New York. The largest shareholder was the Rockefeller-controlled National City Bank with 30,000 shares. The second largest was the Morgan-controlled First National Bank with 15,000 shares. The fact that foreign banks purchased substantial shares in the Federal Reserve System ensured that the economic course of the United States no longer would be controlled and directed solely by representatives of the American people or duly appointed officials of the Treasury Department, but also by a clique of very wealthy bankers from London, Paris, Hamburg, Berlin, and Rome. The real power. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York quickly emerged as the fountainhead of the system. Since Manhattan remained the financial capital of the nation, the other 11 banks, in the words of Frederick Lundberg, became
so many expensive mausoleums erected to salve the local pride and quell the Jacksonian fears of the hinterland.
These banks were set up in Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Richmond, Atlanta, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Dallas, and San Francisco. The May 19, 1914 organization chart of the New York Fed showed that of the 203,053 shares issued, Rockefeller's National City Bank purchased 30,000 shares, while the Morgan Baker First National Bank took 15,000 shares. The National Bank of Commerce, of which Paul Warburg was a principal shareholder, acquired 21,000 shares. Hanover Bank, with Lord Rothschild as a director, gained 10,200 shares. The Rockefeller-owned Chase National Bank took 6,000 shares, as did the Morgan-affiliated Chemical Bank. These six banks owned 40% of the stock in the New York Fed. Other shareholders, according to European trade specialist Gary Kaa, were the Rothschild Bank of London and Berlin, the Lazard Brothers Bank of Paris, the Warburg Bank of Hamburg and Amsterdam, the Israel Seif Bank of Italy, Lehman Brothers of New York, and Goldman Sachs of New York. Benjamin Strong, president of the Morgan Bankers Trust Company, served as the first governor of the New York Fed. Under Strong's leadership, the Federal Reserve of New York, unsuspected by the nations, became interlinked with the Bank of England and the Banque de France. It alone became authorized to receive massive deposits of gold from other central banks. By 1924, a massive vault, half the size of a football field, was built 86 feet beneath the Federal Reserve Bank on the corner of William and Nassau Street in Lower Manhattan. 3 years later, the vault contained 10% of the world's entire supply of monetary gold. A progressive income tax. By authorizing a central bank to control the country's money supply and the value of a dollar, Congress enabled government spending to skyrocket beyond all expectation. Politicians now could commit to projects that cost millions of dollars more than the existing revenue. The Fed, in turn, could purchase the excess debt by printing more paper money, thereby inflating the economy. States, seduced by the federal deep pockets but lacking any mechanism to manufacture debt, would become dependent on Washington, D.C. for revenue, thereby reversing the traditional relationship that existed between state and federal governments. And the taxpayers would bear the brunt of bloated governments, thanks to the enactment of a graduated income tax. Prior to 1913, there was no income tax in America, except for a period during the Civil War and the early years of Reconstruction. The federal government existed on other sources of revenue, including tariffs and excise taxes. Not being able to spend or borrow heavily, the federal government remained limited in its scope of operations. Moreover, in 1895, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Pollock v. Farmers Loan Trust, ruled that the 2% income tax that President Grover Cleveland attempted to impose on the American people to be unconstitutional. Due to this ruling, a federal income tax could only be imposed by constitutional amendment. The man who proposed this amendment to Congress was the same senator who advanced the plan for the Federal Reserve, Nelson Aldrich. The average John Doe who voted for the approval of the amendment fancied that the progressive tax would soak the rich. He was unaware that the rich could channel their wealth into their tax-exempt foundations, or that they would manufacture losses and expenses to lessen their reported earnings. 20 years after the passage of the Revenue Act of 1933, a congressional committee discovered that J.P. Morgan, Jr., one of the richest men in the country, was not paying any income tax at all. The people had been duped. Part 3. War to End All Wars.
I am concerned for the security of our great nation, not so much because of any threat from without, but because of the insidious forces working from within.
General Douglas MacArthur.
It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes, a principle which, if acted on, would save one half the wars of the world.
Thomas Jefferson.
The invisible money power is working to control and enslave mankind. It financed communism, fascism, Marxism, Zionism, socialism. All of these are directed to making the United States a member of a world government.
American Mercury Magazine, December 1957, page 92. 12. The Serpent's Egg.
Men of wealth should form a synthetic free enterprise system based on cradle-to-grave schooling. The people who advance through schooling will be given licenses to lead profitable lives. All licenses will be tied to forms of schooling. This way, the entire economy can be controlled, and people will have a motivation to learn what you want them to learn. It also places the minds of all children in the hands of a few social engineers.
Andrew Carnegie, Wealth, 1889. Within the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's plan to create a world without war, a serpent's egg had been planted. This came to light in 1964, when the research staff of the Rees Commission, a congressional committee set up to probe tax-exempt foundations, came upon the minutes of a meeting of the CEIP trustees in 1911, which was held to discuss the question, "Is there any means known to man more effective than war to alter the life of an entire people?" The trustees concluded that only war could serve to set the stage for world government. At the end of the meeting, they resolved to influence the diplomatic machinery toward launching a world conflagration by gaining control of the U.S. State Department. Their resolution produced profound results. Root gained the position as the American delegate to the Hague Tribunal. Shotwell came to write the Social Security clauses of the Versailles Treaty. Brookings received the appointment to chair the War Industries Board and the Price Fixing Committee. Foster became a fixture in the office of Robert Lansing, Wilson's Secretary of State, who, by a happy stroke of coincidence, happened to be Foster's son-in-law. Eliot, an avowed pacifist, wrote articles about the necessity of supporting the Allied forces for major U.S. newspapers. Choate embarked on a speaking tour to promote American involvement in the European conflict, and Dodge, who commenced to sell millions in munitions to the Allies, emerged as Wilson's financier. The Rise of the Round Table. The power brokers were on the move in Great Britain as well. As soon as the Great War broke out, members of the Round Table began to dine every Monday night at the residence of Leopold Amory, who had been recruited to join the group while serving as a correspondent for the London Times during the Boer War. The Monday night diners included Lord Milner, Philip Kerr, Lord Lothian, Lord Robert Brand, Reginald Brett, Lord Esher, Geoffrey Dawson, Lord Waldorf Astor, Baron John Buchan, and Sir Leander Jameson of the infamous Jameson Raid. By producing a flow of leaks to the British press, they managed to obtain Herbert Henry Asquith's ouster as Britain's Prime Minister. In his place, they arranged the appointment of David Lloyd George, an adjunct member of the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had created. As soon as Lloyd George assumed occupancy of 10 Downing Street, Milner became Secretary of War. Philip Kerr became Lloyd George's personal secretary. Leopold Amory became Assistant Secretary to the War Cabinet. Waldorf Astor became Lloyd George's Parliamentary Secretary. Robert Brand became Deputy Chairman of the British Mission in Washington, D.C. John Buchan became Lloyd George's Director of Intelligence, and Reginald Brett became the de facto head of the British Intelligence Service. The British Empire was now firmly in the hands of a cabal intent upon making the dream of Cecil Rhodes a political reality. American isolationism. Prior to 1917, the United States remained an isolationist nation that stayed clear from all foreign entanglements. This was in keeping with the advice of George Washington, who said in his farewell address,
"The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible. So far as we have already formed engagements, let them be fulfilled with perfect good faith. Here, let us stop. Europe has a set of primary interests which to us have none, or a very remote relation. Hence, she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. Hence, therefore, it must be unwise in us to implicate ourselves by artificial ties in the ordinary vicissitudes of her politics, or the ordinary combinations and collisions of her friendships or enmities."
Similarly, Thomas Jefferson, in his inaugural address, pledged
peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none.
This tradition of isolationism was fortified by the millions of immigrants who came to America to escape from oppression. During the 1800s, the United States spanned North America without departing from its stance of isolationism. It fought the War of 1812, the Mexican War, and the Spanish-American War without forming foreign alliances or fighting on European soil. The Money Men's Mole. But with Wilson in the White House, America's Money Trust gained control of the Oval Office, thanks to Edward Mandel House, the president's closest friend and advisor. House, an ardent Anglophile who had been educated in England, was credited with swinging the 1912 Democratic Convention in Baltimore behind Wilson's nomination. He became Woodrow Wilson's constant companion from that point onwards, with his own suite of rooms in the White House. He was also in direct, sometimes daily, contact with J.P. Morgan Jr., Jacob Schiff, Paul Warburg, and Democrat senators who sponsored the Federal Reserve Bill. House guided Wilson in every aspect of foreign and domestic policy, chose his cabinet, and established the first policies of his new administration. Staged terrorism. The interests between Carnegie and the House of Morgan became intertwined when Carnegie became one of the co-signers of a $500 million loan from J.P. Morgan & Company to the Anglo-French Financial Commission in 1914. The $500 million to fund the Allied war against Germany represented the largest foreign loan in Wall Street history. It was five times greater than the previous record holder, the $100 million loan to Great Britain for the Boer War. With such a tremendous amount at stake, it was essential to tip the scales in favor of the Allies by securing the participation of the United States in the conflict. An incident had to be manufactured that would provoke the American people to abandon their stance of isolationism and to enter the fracas. It came with the sinking of the Lusitania by a German submarine on May 7, 1915. 1,198 civilians, including 128 Americans, died when the ship went down, and the seemingly unprovoked act of aggression against a passenger ocean liner served to arouse anti-German sentiment throughout the country. Many of the 767 survivors popped up and down in the waves for 3 hours, while seagulls swooped from the sky to peck out the eyes of the floating corpses. Few Americans realized that the sinking and delayed rescue had been planned by Winston Churchill and members of the British Admiralty, who were acting in tandem with Britain's Board of Trade, Colonel Edward M. House of the Wilson administration, and American industrialists, including J.P. Morgan, who had provided massive loans to Great Britain and the Allied forces. The American public was not informed that the Lusitania was transporting 6 million rounds of ammunition and other military munitions to Britain. Upon the order of President Wilson, the ship's original manifest was hidden away in the archives of the Treasury Department. Nor were they made aware that Churchill and other members of the Admiralty had directed the Lusitania to proceed at considerably reduced speed, and without escort, to the precise location within the Irish Sea where the German U-boat was lying in wait. And the public, for the most part, remained oblivious that the Germans had placed large ads in the New York newspapers to dissuade Americans from boarding the ocean liner. Fake news. After the sinking of the Lusitania, stories about German atrocities began to capture headlines in U.S. newspapers, including the New York Times. One story reported that German soldiers were deliberately mutilating Belgian babies by cutting off their hands, in some cases even eating them. Another atrocity story involved a Canadian soldier who had supposedly been crucified with bayonets by the Germans. Many Canadians claimed to have witnessed the event, yet they all provided different versions of how it had happened. The Canadian High Command investigated the matter, concluding that it was untrue. Other reports circulated of Belgian women, often nuns, who had their breasts cut off by the Germans. A story appeared in the Times about German corpse factories, where bodies of German soldiers were supposedly turned into glycerin for weapons or food for hogs. The stories produced moral outrage throughout America and a hatred for the bloodthirsty Hun. Few realized that the news came from Milner's Round Table and was circulated by J.P. Jack Morgan, Jr., who had gained control of America's newspapers. On February 9, 1917, Congressman Oscar Calloway inserted this statement within the congressional record about Morgan's ability to control and manipulate the national news. In March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interests, the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests, and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States and sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press in the United States. These 12 men worked the problems out by selecting 179 newspapers and then began, by an elimination process, to retain only those necessary for the purpose of controlling the general policy of the daily press throughout the country. They found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest papers. The 25 papers were agreed upon. Emissaries were sent to purchase the policy, national and international, of these papers. An agreement was reached. The policy of the papers was bought, to be paid for by the month. An editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interests of the purchasers. This contract is in existence at the present time, and it accounts for the news columns of the daily press of the country being filled with all sorts of preparedness arguments and misrepresentations as to the present condition of the United States Army and Navy, and the possibility and probability of the United States being attacked by foreign foes. This policy also included the suppression of everything in opposition to the wishes of the interests served.
The effectiveness of this scheme has been conclusively demonstrated by the character of the stuff carried in the daily press throughout the country since March 1915. They have resorted to anything necessary to commercialize public sentiment and sandbag the National Congress into making extravagant and wasteful appropriations for the Army and Navy under false pretense that it was necessary. Their stock argument is that it is patriotism. They are playing on every prejudice and passion of the American people.
In the post-war years, investigations in Britain and France revealed that these stories were false and had been generated to increase popular support for America's entry into World War I. The real war. With the media in the control of Morgan and in turn Rothschild, the American people never really knew the reason the doughboys were being dispatched to the trenches of France. They had been informed by leading journalists, including Roundtable member Walter Lippmann, that the cause of the war was the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, by a Serbian nationalist on June 28, 1914. The murder, most Americans were led to believe, prompted conflict between Russia, Serbia's ally, and Germany, the Austro-Hungarian protector. They were shielded from the fact that the war, like all wars, had been sparked by economic interests, and that the conflict had been in the works for decades. The creation of the German Empire under Bismarck upset the balance of powers that had existed in Europe for more than two centuries. England ruled supreme over the continent until 1871. This supremacy had been repeatedly challenged by Spain and by France, but England always remained victorious. The fact that Germany now grew stronger by acquiring colonies in Africa and by building up its military force was a severe threat to the economic hegemony of England. To counteract the rise of Germany, the international bankers, who at that time were excluded from the economic development in Germany, sought for ways to limit and control Germany. Between 1894 and 1907, a number of international treaties were signed to have Russia, France, England, and other nations unite against Germany in the case of war. It was the task of the so-called Committee of 300 at the Round Table, which later became known as Chatham House, to set the stage for world war. Members of the committee included Lord Albert Grey, Lord Arnold Toynbee, Lord Alfred Milner, and H.J. Mackinder, who became known as the father of geopolitics. Edward Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, and Walter Lippmann, the founding editor of the New Republic, were the American specialists of the committee. Lord Rothermere, a.k.a. Harold Harmsworth, used his newspaper, the Daily Mail, as a tool to try out their social conditioning techniques on his readers. After a test period of 6 months, they had found that 87% of the public had formed opinions without rational or critical thought processes. Thereupon, the English working class became subjected to a constant onslaught of propaganda designed to convince them that they were obliged to send their sons by the millions to their deaths. The experiment verified that human beings can be conditioned as easily as rats. 13. Making hay.
My God, this is living history. Everything we are doing and saying is thrilling. It will be read by a thousand generations. Think of that. Why, I would not be out of this glorious, delicious war for anything the world could give me.
Winston Churchill, January 1915. Joined at the right hip to the Bank of England and the left hip to J.P. Morgan, the House of Rothschild was deeply involved in manipulating events to ensure that the massive loans it had provided to the Allied forces would be repaid. After the Battle of Jutland in 1916, when Germany appeared on the verge of winning the war, Lord Rothschild worked to secure America's intervention in the struggle with the aid of Morgan and Louis Brandeis, one of Wilson's trusted advisors. In exchange for this effort, Rothschild received assurance from Lord Arthur Balfour, England's former Prime Minister, present Foreign Secretary, and leading member of the Round Table, that his group of Zionists would be granted a homeland in Palestine at the end of the struggle. This assurance came in the form of a letter, dated November 2, 1917, which read as follows.
Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing Jewish colonies in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in other countries. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours, Arthur Balfour.
This declaration was of inestimable value to the House of Rothschild, since it possessed vast economic holdings in the Middle and Far East and wanted its own state, replete with its own military, to ward off any aggressor that threatened these interests. Prolonging the war. Once America entered World War I, the Carnegie trustees under Elihu Root sent a telegram to President Woodrow Wilson in which they urged him not to end the war too soon. Jennings C. Wise, Wilson's biographer, acknowledged that the war had been escalated and prolonged to lay the foundation for world government. He wrote, "Whether or not British Ambassador Sir Cecil Spring Rice was correct in his belief that Theodore Marburg, the force behind the Carnegie-funded League to Enforce Peace, and the Internationalists had brought on the war, certain it is they proposed to make hay out of it." The prolongation of the war was in keeping with Carnegie's wishes. In an article for the Washington Post that appeared on January 24, 1915, 2 years before Wilson deployed troops to Europe, Carnegie wrote,
"In these times when half of our fair world is being blackened by the fire and smoke of shot and shell, when men are at each other's throats and civilization's progress has suffered its most serious setback of centuries, I am asked if I can find any possible prospect for lasting peace. To this I answer an emphatic yes. It is my firm belief and opinion that never at any time in the history of the world did the future hold out such definite promise for permanent peace as it does now. The present war is so appalling and shocking that it in itself is probably doing more to put an end to war than any peace propaganda could have accomplished in half a century. The longer that this war continues, and the more terrible its results, the stronger the argument for permanent world peace."
He should have added that war was also incredibly profitable. Blood money. By 1917, the British War Office had borrowed $2.5 billion from the House of Morgan and other Wall Street banks. Only $27 million had been loaned to the Germans. As soon as war was declared, Congress voted $1 billion in credit for England and France. $200 million was sent to England immediately and was applied to the Morgan account. The vast quantity of money needed to finance the war was created by the Federal Reserve System, which means it was collected from Americans through that hidden tax called inflation. As soon as the American troops were deployed, the House of Morgan took every possible step to assure itself that the private debts that the British government owed the bankers and bondholders would be transferred to the U.S. government in exchange for U.S. bonds or treasury notes. In other words, historian Roberta Dyer writes, "The Morgans ensured that it was repaid before the war was over, while the American Treasury,
that is, the American people, assumed the British debts, which because of post-war debt renunciation were never fully paid.
Profits of war. The exigencies of the massive conflict forced England and France to go heavily into debt. When their respective central banks and local merchant banks no longer could meet the ever-increasing demand for cash, the beleaguered governments, under the guidance of the Rothschilds, turned to the House of Morgan to serve as sales agent for their bonds. Most of the money raised in this fashion was recycled to the United States through the purchase of weapons and material from Morgan holding companies or firms within the orbit of the Morgan Bank. Price gouging remained unchecked, since the House of Morgan had been singled out by the Wilson administration to serve as the U.S. purchase agent for the Allies. A commission was paid on all transactions, when the money was borrowed and again when the money was spent. Under such a lucrative arrangement, Morgan and his associates were hardly anxious to see hostilities come to a close. In 1915, Thomas W. Lamont, a partner of Morgan and Company, delivered the following speech to the American Academy of Political and Social Science in Philadelphia.
"We are turning from a debtor into a creditor. We are piling up prodigious export trade balance. Many of our manufacturers and merchants have been doing a wonderful business in articles relating to the war, World War I. So heavy have been the war orders running into the hundreds of millions of dollars that now their effect is beginning to spread to general business. The question of trade and financial supremacy must be determined by several factors, a chief one of which is the duration of the war. If the war should come to an end in the near future, we should probably find Germany, whose export trade is now almost wholly cut off, swinging back into keen competition very promptly. Another factor that is dependent on the duration of the war is as to whether we shall become lenders to foreign nations upon a really large scale. Shall we become lenders upon a really stupendous scale to these foreign governments? If the war continues long enough to encourage us to take such a position, then inevitably we would become a creditor instead of a debtor nation, and such a development sooner or later would tend to bring about the dollar instead of the pound sterling as the international basis of exchange."
The money began to flow in January of 1915, when the House of Morgan signed a contract with the British Army Council and the Admiralty. At the advent of modern warfare, the first purchase, curiously, was for horses, and the amount tendered was $12 million. But that was but the first drop in the banker's bucket. Total purchases from the Allies eventually climbed to an astronomical $3 billion. Morgan's office at 23 Wall Street became mobbed by brokers and manufacturers seeking to cut a deal. Each month, Jack Morgan presided over purchases that equaled the gross national product of the entire world just one generation before. The promise of communism. In 1917, America's Money Trust, who created the Pilgrim Societies and the Round Table, funded the Russian Revolution with the conviction not only that it would spark a universal movement for global government, but also that the revolution would permit them to give control of Russia's vast natural resources. Jacob Schiff, head of the New York investment firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company, shelled out $20 million to the Bolsheviks. Millions more came from the House of Morgan and members of the British and American Roundtable. The appeal of communism to the Money Trust resided in the fact that it represented a monopolist system of government, a government over which enterprising industrialists and bankers could gain control through loans to the government, the manipulation of the country's centralized banking system, and, of course, bribes. Communism further represented government regulation of all facets of business and industry, a notion that met with the resounding approval of the leading American bankers and industrialists. Regulation, they realized, could be used to establish exclusive monopolies and to feed on tax revenue. The first American regulatory agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, was created at the behest of the railroad owners, not the railroad users. When the Federal Reserve came under consideration for congressional approval in 1912, Henry Davison, J.P. Morgan's partner, said, "I would rather have regulation and control than free enterprise." The passing of the old order. Small wonder, therefore, that the American ruling elite saw in the rise of communism their hope for the future. In the January 13th issue of the New York World, William Boyce Thompson, Federal Reserve Bank Director and founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote, "Russia is pointing the way to great and sweeping world changes. It is not in Russia alone that the old order is passing. There is a lot of the old order in America, and that is going too. I'm glad it is so. When I sat and watched those democratic conclaves in Russia, I felt that I would welcome a similar scene in the United States." After the Bolsheviks seized power, Standard Oil, under the direction of the House of Rockefeller, purchased the Russian oil fields, set up a refinery for the Soviets, and made arrangements to market the refined oil in Europe. During the 1920s, the Rockefellers' Chase Bank set up the American-Russian Chamber of Commerce, financed the raw material exports of the Soviets, and sold Russian bonds to American investors. Conditioning the masses. The war had been orchestrated from start to end, not by politicians and military officials, but rather by British bankers and businessmen who sought to preserve, at all costs, British economic hegemony. It was fueled by American financiers and industrialists, who made immense profits from the bloody conflict. And it was prolonged by the efforts of the trustees of leading American foundations, including the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which believed that the phoenix of a new world order would emerge from the ashes of the conflagration. Few American scholars questioned the necessity for the conflict and the fact that the incredible bloodshed was not produced by what St. Augustine would call a just cause. In schools and colleges throughout America, students were conditioned to accept the carefully prepared script that explained the causes of the conflict in terms of conflicting alliances. Almost no one took the effort to look behind the curtain. War and Inscription. On April 6, 1917, the joint sessions of Congress approved President Wilson's request for a declaration of war against the German Empire. U.S. intervention in the conflict was justified by Wilson's belief that the war would make the world safe for democracy. Six senators voted against the declaration, including Robert La Follette of Wisconsin, and 50 members of the House of Representatives opposed it, including Jeanette Rankin of Montana, America's first congresswoman. Despite government appeals for 1 million volunteers, only 63,000 enlisted in the first 6 weeks, forcing Congress to institute compulsory military inscription. Under the 1917 Espionage Act, hundreds of Americans who opposed the draft were tossed into prison, including political activist Eugene Debs, who said, "Let the capitalists do their own fighting and furnish their own corpses, and there will never be another war on the face of the earth." The birth of the military-industrial complex. The war gave rise to modern warfare. Huge plants sprouted up throughout the United States to produce military aircraft, submarines, battleships, aircraft carriers, tanks, portable machine guns, flamethrowers, and automatic rifles. Military spending rose until it constituted 22% of the GNP in 1918. The principal beneficiaries were U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel, DuPont Chemical, Kennecott, and General Electric, all of which were related to the House of Morgan. Enterprising defense companies set up shop, including General Dynamics, which produced submarines, and Boeing, which produced aircraft. The military-industrial complex had come into existence. By the end of the war, Oil had become the most valuable commodity on Earth. Prior to the war, industry was fueled by coal, and places like Scranton and Wilkes-Barre became boomtowns, attracting thousands of immigrants to eke out a living in the anthracite mines of northeast Pennsylvania. But oil was cheaper, cleaner, and more labor-efficient, since it produced no residue that required removal. No naval issue would affect Britain.